Welcome to Design Downtime, the podcast where we celebrate the joys of living a balanced creative life. I'm your host, Guy Siegel, a design director in Toronto, Canada, and I invite you to join me on this journey as we redefine what it means to be a successful design professional. Let's break free from the shackles of hustle culture and embrace the full spectrum of human experience, because life is too precious to be spent only in pursuit of productivity. Today, I'm thrilled to talk to Dan Brown. After running boutique design firm 8Shapes for 18 years, Dan struck out on his own, starting Curious Squid Design Lab to continue providing high-quality information architecture and UX consulting to enterprise organizations. Through Curious Squid, Dan helps product teams build complex products to align with user needs while meeting business objectives. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he produced the podcast A Lens a Day, Conversations about Information Architecture, and currently co-hosts and produces the podcast Unchecked, The Architecture of Disinformation. Dan's passion for information architecture is eclipsed only by his passion for board games. Dan, welcome to the show.
Guy, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And today, you're going to talk about a subject that's near and dear to my heart, board games.
Yeah, I'm excited to do it.
I'm amazed it took me this long to get to this subject.
I am too, but I kind of understand it. I mean, as you pointed out in your intro, I am a fairly regular podcaster, and I have not been this nervous to do a podcast ever. And I think it's because board gamers can be very passionate, opinionated, thoughtful about the hobby. And I'm really worried about getting something wrong. I'm really worried about missing something too. It's such a vast hobby, and it's such a vast market of games. I saw someone who follows the industry very closely said that 2,000 new board games come out every year, which is just a tremendous number of board games. And there's just no way to stay up on it all, but it also means that there's something out there for everyone. So like I said, I don't blame you for taking this long. I'm honored to be the person to represent board games, and hopefully I will not be quite so nervous as we get into the conversation.
So let's actually start with the assumption, and we're going to get stuff wrong, and we're going to miss stuff, and we're going to forget stuff, because again, you said thousands of games, new games every year.
Yep.
Let's start easy. Let's ease you into this with my usual first question, the origin story. How did you get into, let's say, hobby board games?
Yeah, I've always really liked gaming. I would say that I didn't play a lot of games as a kid because, I don't know, games in the 70s and 80s just weren't as compelling. I struggled to kind of get into like the deep hobby games. I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling me about sort of some really, you know, he's a contemporary of mine. He was played some really complicated games back then. There were a lot of kind of war game type things. I didn't really get into that stuff. I played a lot of role-playing games, and I really wanted to design board games back then, but I could never find anything that really, really I clicked with. So the extent of my experience back then was Monopoly, and my sister and I would always just get into enormous fights over that game. And when I was in, let's say, my late 20s, maybe early 30s, I heard about a game that I came to understand was called Eurostyle. And what that meant was that it was not like Monopoly in that people would be eliminated, right? That people always had a chance to accumulate points, and that by the end of the game, you would just simply total up the points that someone would have. And the fact that people couldn't be eliminated was what struck me. And I thought maybe, just maybe, this would be a game that I could get my wife to play. And that game was called Carcassonne. And what's delightful about Carcassonne is she really likes jigsaw puzzles. And the way Carcassonne works is you pull a tile from a bag of tiles, and that has map elements on it. And you add the tile to the ever-increasing map. You're all building this map together. So it'll have road pieces and other kind of things. So you have to make sure everything connects together. and you put a piece on the tile to indicate which part of the tile you are claiming as yours. And then the points at the end of the game are based on where you've placed all your pieces. And it was delightful. And we played it. We roped our friends, the Melzers, into it. And we would just play. We play Carcassonne on the regular. And I think that was my sort of gateway to this hobby, you know, in my adult years. So that was really where it started.
That's a really good point because, yes, there are board games that are intended for solo play, for one player, but most of them are not. And in order to enjoy board games, we both know that you need other people to play with.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Which can sometimes be the challenge.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it got so challenging that I ended up making my own competitor, my own players with my children. And that has been... that has sort of made it more rewarding all over again, right? Because as a parent, you get to kind of experience watching them learn how to play. And I know we're not supposed to talk about our work here, but as a UX professional, I have this sort of inherent curiosity about how people engage with systems. And a board game is just a system with very particular rules and very particular constraints. So it's really interesting to watch, yes, my children, but it turns out also lots of humans kind of engage with systems in this way. I rarely win the board games that I play. People think that because I'm an avid board gamer that I must be good at them. I am terrible at them. And I find that the best games are the ones where even when you lose, you want to play it again because you find the system so engaging. And for me, it's also watching other people engage with the system.
There is a... I'm not a big fan of this dichotomy, but theme and mechanisms in board games. And it's sort of a, people put it on a spectrum, but I think it's a bit misleading. But in very broad strokes, there are board games that lean heavier on the setting, on the, I would say, establishing a mental model that that models something in a real world or something that's easier. For me, it's easier to digest because, oh yeah, this is how I think a car factory probably works, and it's easier for me to learn that versus something that's more abstract and relies more on a mechanism, and it can apply to, you can, you know, put a paint job of any setting on it. Where do you fall on this weird spectrum?
That's a deep question. We just dove right in to the deep end on this.
We're not afraid of deep conversations here.
I think what I'm always looking for is a game where the mechanics themselves evoke the themes. I'll give you a good example. A classic, I guess a modern classic, is a game called Agricola, which is what you would call a worker placement game. This is where you have a little family of workers and they go out and they run a subsistence farm. And if you had told me before I got started with this hobby that a game about 17th century subsistence farming would be fun, I would be like, what are you talking about? I don't want to touch that. But it is one of the most fun games. And there's just a ton of variety. I love this game. And it was one of the first, it's probably the first worker placement game I played. And that's a style of game that I really like. But anyway, right, the intent is you send your little worker out to do a job. And that job might yield, you've acquired some more sheep, or you can build a fence, right? And there's this kind of beautiful mesh between the mechanics of the game and the theme of the game. I really like that a lot. I think there are some where the mechanics of the game, where the theme feels, as people say, kind of slapped on, or you can get to a place where the theme is so, where there's not even really a theme, it's more abstract. And I think there's something delightful about that. But again, as a user experience professional, I'm always looking for, how does someone draw me in to the story too? I'll give you a good example. There's a newer game out called White Castle, and my son and I only played it once, but it's got kind of a, let's call it a Japanese garden type theme. And the mechanics do feel somewhat separate from the theme, but it's a very delightful, very sort of aesthetically pleasing game too. And there's this little bridge and the dice sit on this bridge. It's very cute. So I'm really drawn in by that, even though it feels like the theme is really meant to kind of help sort of ground the game, but not necessarily is what the game is about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So in a way, your first entry into this hobby, Carcassonne, has a theme. You're building a city, you're building these castles, and you're also placing, you know, you have monasteries and you have farmers and you have all those things. That is also helps establish that kind of world that you're imagining yourself into, right? You're this model of this is what a medieval countryside looks like in a way. After that game, what's next? Because we said on the other end of a spectrum, there's thousands of new games coming out every year. When did you realize that, oh, wow, this hobby is way more than I thought it is?
That's tough. I don't remember what happened next, because there's clearly something happened, because I went from owning Carcassonne to owning hundreds of games. And so obviously something happened in there, and I must have blacked out during it. But some of the games that I gravitated towards were things that I could engage my kids with. One of the reasons why I went towards Agricola was because it was such a, you know, where the theme was very visible in the game. And in fact, we almost used it as a toy before we used it as a game, right? This sort of, a lot of the elements are kind of fun to just set up your own little farm without playing the game. Another early game that we did was Dominion, which is kind of a classic deck builder game. I've since sold all my Dominions because we don't play it anymore, and it sort of lost its shine, but it was a great game, and it's a deck builder is a very common mechanism. There's a lot of deck builder type games out there, and this is one of those things where the theme feels very separate, like from the mechanism of the game itself. In a deck builder, you have a deck of cards. You can buy new cards to add to your deck, or use the cards to generate points, and that's different in every game. In some of these, you can use the cards to defeat enemies as well, another way to generate points. With Dominion, you're trying to buy kind of different sizes of estate. And again, the mechanism was simple enough where my children, when they were young, could kind of pick up on what they needed to do. They could use the points to, you know, spend money to buy a new card, or spend money to buy points, essentially. It was a very, very simple mechanism. So that was sort of the next step of the game obsession, was like trying to find things that I thought would appeal to the folks in my household and that I could sort of get my kids involved with. I think the next game I became really obsessed with is a game called Seven Wonders. And this is what they call a card drafting game, where you have a hand of cards and you just, literally the whole game is you put down a card and you pass your hand to the next person. And it's kind of this very simple, very elegant mechanism that can end up doing a whole lot depending on what card you put down. One of the things I liked about this game was that everyone plays at the same time. So you all put down a card together, which meant it moved very fast. It wasn't directly competitive, right? I wasn't doing things necessarily to hurt other people. And so that appealed to the folks in my household who don't like that kind of direct competitiveness. That game is still in my collection. And in fact, I lent it to my older son, who's now in college. And he's been getting his college friends interested in that game. It feels really good to kind of pass that along. But anyway, that was sort of the next game. And then I think it sort of snowballed from there.
So I definitely remember, I think we had similar path in sort of starting the collection. And a lot of it was driven by what I think my wife and my family would engage with. Sometimes I was incorrect.
I am often incorrect. That is a game I lose frequently.
Oh.
Guessing the game that they would play, that they would like. I'm getting much better at it. I've only known my wife for 30 years, so I still have some time. But that is an interesting challenge. And I actually really like knowing a lot of board games, because I like being able to recommend games to people. I like hearing sort of what their particular situation is. I want to play with older folks, or we really like party games, right? Where we lots of people shouting and stuff like that. So I love hearing about that stuff and being able to recommend games based on, you know, different situations. But I'm sorry, you were saying.
That's actually a really good point. I'd love to hear more about that, because I'd love to hear your success stories where, you know what, you didn't really think people would gel with something or connect with a game and they did, or games that you thought this is a sure thing and it fell flat?
That's a good. There's a game, a relatively recent game called Ark Nova. And this has like all the elements of a game that my wife Sarah would kind of dislike. It's very complex. Like there's a lot of moving parts to it. There's some element of competition where you can kind of steal cards from each other. And she loves this game. And I think it's because this is one of those games where the theme and the mechanisms are like very closely tied together, because you're building a zoo. And so you have a little map in front of you and you can acquire these different tiles to, she likes things with tiles, I guess, you can add to your zoo. And I asked her to play with us. I was like, this is really complicated. There's just so much going on. It's hard to keep track of everything. Mechanism, like the main mechanism of the game is not especially intuitive. And every time I'm like, should we play a board game? She's like, can we play Ark Nova? So this is one of those games where I was like, I didn't think this was really going to fly, but it ends up being her favorite game. Now I'm hopeful that they come out with a slightly simpler version, because this is one of those games that takes a long time to set up and then we can never finish it. And in our house, we can't leave games set up because we have cats, and cats are notorious anti-board game. They have anti-board game bias. So I really got into a style of game called an engine builder, which I think is really what Ark Nova is. This is where you sort of accumulate cards, usually, that have different abilities on them. And they're every turn, those abilities might activate, right? And so you want to try and build a tableau of cards that all work well together to generate points. That's what an engine builder is. There's a very, very popular game out. It's been out for several years now called Wingspan. That's considered an engine builder. You're collecting birds, and those birds kind of have different abilities. And depending on what you play, all those abilities may activate to generate more points. Ultimately, Ark Nova is an engine builder, but what's cool about engine builders is you can kind of continue to pare them down until it's very, very basic. I played an engine builder that I really liked. A good friend of mine, Kim, recommended it, called Furnace, and it is like the most basic engine builder. I love it. I think it's really cool how pared down they got. You're basically running, to be honest, like a 19th century kind of factory, basically.
Yeah, it's very much a age of industry.
Yes, yeah. But again, the actual theme is almost irrelevant to how the mechanism works, unlike Ark Nova, which feels a little more closely tied. It feels like the most pared down engine builder that I've played. I loved it. Everybody else I played with hated it. And now it sits on my shelf waiting for me to be able to pull it out with someone. And I've been fascinated. I've collected a few engine builders because I'm sort of really interested to see sort of how, like, the, you know, what's between Furnace, which I think is a very basic one, and Ark Nova, which is a very complex one. Wingspan is somewhere kind of a little closer to Furnace, I would say. Are there, you know, what else is out there? The one that we acquired that I did think Sarah would like, and we played this with our friends, is called Earth. And you build this tableau of trees, basically. I really like that one. That felt sort of like a nice, not too overly complex, really nicely themed, because it was about trees and kind of enough interesting decision making that you can make on each turn.
Okay, I'm going to mention the word design.
We got to do it.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about the board game, the game itself, as an aesthetic object.
One of the great things about turning 50 is that you can start to justify acquiring things because they are like having art in your house. And so even if I never play a game, I feel like merely owning the game gives me pleasure, which is, I think, a little unhinged, but it is a rationale that works. I just acquired through Kickstarter a game called Artistry. And I did it, Sarah found it, because it has is an Art Nouveau theme. And the artwork on these cards is stunning. I opened the box and I don't think I even ordered anything particularly premium, but the components were freaking gorgeous. It was two boards and they were both had wooden borders. It's a bunch of kind of resin tiles with little designs on them and a bag to put the tiles in. The cards were gorgeous. And I was like, this truly does feel like a work of art. And it makes me want to play it more. And I always like to think of myself as like, you know what? If it's just a bunch of cardboard, I'll do it. I'll give it a try. But there was something that really drew me in to the aesthetic. Let me give you another example. And I think this is a really interesting point. If we could also not just talk about design, but maybe talk about the state of the world at the moment, because board games really exploded in the last, you know, let's call it 10 years. And part of, I mean, it's been exploding. And I think what one of the consequences of that explosion is a greater investment in the quality of the components themselves. I had pre-ordered Matt Leacock's new game, Fate of the Fellowship. Matt Leacock is a designer. He created this, one of the biggest games ever called Pandemic. He is sort of the king of cooperative games. And cooperative games were huge. And for a long time, Matt Leacock was really the only one doing good co-op games. Matt Leacock is also kind of a hero of mine because he was a UX designer. He came from the UX space. So I intersected with him at conferences. Anyway, he sort of put all the experience that he had from the pandemic games that he had made into a Lord of the Rings themed game. And I pre-ordered it. It just arrived and I pulled it out of the box and we haven't played it yet, but I was blown away by the quality and the components. I mean, Matt Leacock always designs really thoughtful, really interesting games, but the board was extremely detailed. The cards looked really good. You know, it's Lord of the Rings, so there's a lot of lore to work with, but everything hung together really, really nicely. And again, I'm super excited to play this game. We're obviously huge Lord of the Rings fans, obviously huge fans of cooperative games, but just seeing the quality of these components really drew me in. But we're sort of at the tail end of this, I think, because of where the world is at the moment. It's going to become much more expensive to make games of this quality. And try not to predict the future, but I'm genuinely curious to see what happens to games moving forward as this, you know, kind of the pressures of the global economy continue to make it much, much harder for the U.S. And North America to interact with other parts of the world. Anyway, you had asked about aesthetics, and that was what these two games just came into my collection. I was like, I feel like we've taken a step up, but I'm not sure that we're going to continue that progress, at least in the near future.
You mentioned Matt Leacock came from the world of UX, and I know that every person who is an avid board gamer, or most of them, have at some point designed at least one game. How many have you designed?
That is a good question. I end up designing mostly role-playing games, storytelling games. And I know you've covered that already, so we don't have to go there. I think in part because I have such high standards for the playability of a game that I don't think I could live up to those standards. When the kids were younger, I really did try. My older son has a keen and persistent interest in marine science. He's studying that now in college, but that interest started when he was four. And so I feel like I'm sort of constantly, back then I was really trying to design a game that he and I could play about studying the ocean. And since then, there have been a ton of games about studying the ocean. So I did design a work-related game called Surviving Design Projects. I mean, it's been out for almost 15 years now. I didn't do anything special with the mechanism. It's a mechanism that's well-worn. It's is in Apples to Apples is a game that I stole it from. It's also used in Cards Against Humanity. And the intent, it's a very sort of Dan intent, if I can specify it like that, which is not really about the game itself, but about the conversation that people have when they play the game. And the intent of the way the game is played is that someone plays a card that describes a complicated situation, complicated, let's call it sort of a political situation in a design project. Maybe someone introduces new requirements at the last minute, or a decision maker can't actually make a decision, right? So common challenges that we face on design projects, and everyone else makes a suggestion for how to deal with this situation. And the intent was to give people a safe space to practice their kind of collaboration skills or conflict resolution skills without actually having to be in a real conflict. So that's, I would say, besides the role-playing games that I've designed, I've not designed a board game with the exception of this card game.
It actually sounds fascinating. In the beginning, you mentioned that you're concerned about making mistakes when you talk about these board games. And that, to me, immediately brings up the board game community. How are you engaging, if at all, with the board game community?
I have to admit, I don't really engage with the board game community. I like watching short videos, but I don't really have time to watch long videos about board game reviews. I like kind of, you know, poking around on boardgamegeek.com to see what they term the new hotness is. Like, what are people talking about? What games are people interested in? And that's really the extent of it. I don't see this particular hobby as a means for me to engage with a larger community. I think if I had taken more to what they call virtual tabletops, right? Virtual, like the ability to play board games on a computer online, where they try and recreate the feeling of the board game, but online, I wonder if I would have gotten more drawn in to the community. But for me, the appeal of the board game is sort of interacting with people in real time, but also interacting with the components. We have so many of our experiences have been, what's the right word, taken over by keyboards and screens, that I relish experiences that allow me to interact with the real world that don't require a keyboard or a screen. I'm an avid cook too, right? And the fact that I can, you know, do stuff in the kitchen that don't require keyboards and screens is an important escape from my day job.
I couldn't agree more. What are some of the recent board games you've been really excited about, or ones that are coming out?
I knew you were going to ask me that. So I wrote down my list. Well, like I said, I've just acquired the Fate of the Fellowship, Matt Leacock's Lord of the Rings co-op game. I'm beyond excited to try that. And this is not like a Lord of the Rings theme. Like, I'm not like super obsessed with it, but it is a theme that resonates in my house. And there's a relatively new game. I think it's literally called Fellowship of the Ring, the trick-taking game. And this is another co-op game where it's just some decks of cards, really. It goes up to four people. And it's, because it's cooperative, you're all trying to kind of achieve a certain goal, like win a certain number of tricks or win tricks with certain suits in it. We played one game, maybe two rounds, when my older son was home from college, and it was delightful. It's a small game. It's easy to kind of learn, and it's highly themed. So even though the mechanism is fairly common, they did a really good job kind of theming it. I'm really excited to play more of that. My favorite designer is a guy named Jamie Stegmeier. He has a new game out called Vantage. Again, a co-op game. Maybe we're entering a new era of co-op games. He really tried to squeak this in under the wire with the tariffs, but I sense this is sort of a magnum opus for us. He's been working on this game for a long time. It's essentially a storytelling exploration game where you are a part of a crew exploring a planet. You've all landed in a different place on this planet, so you're not overlapping at all. And it comes with probably 1,000 cards, all representing different locations. And he really tried to solve a lot of the problems that are common in these storytelling games, which is that there's sort of a lot of like, not really sure what to do next, or the actions that you can do are not especially clear, or what happens when you fail something, right? I think he's done something cool with that. So he's really kind of pared it down. The mechanism is very simple and straightforward. There's a lot of content in this game because there's also booklets that you can look through to read about the locations that you end up in. My son and I played one game of that, and we were like, there's a lot here, and so we're going to need to set aside some more time to play that. I'll say one more. Earth, that game that I mentioned earlier, the engine builder. I really do love that game. I do think it hits a nice sweet spot, and I just got an upgrade for it called Abundance that had been well reviewed. So that's what I'm excited to play next.
That's awesome. Someone listening to this, they're curious about board games, but they have no idea where to start. Now, I'm not going to ask you to name your, you know, top five entry to the hobby games, but what should they keep in mind as they try to explore this hobby?
What a great question. First of all, find your, what the hobbyists call the FLGS, Friendly Local Game Store. We have a fantastic game store here in the Washington, D.C. area called Labyrinth. They're located in the Capitol Hill area. They're a small business. They've been around maybe 10 years, maybe more at this point. We know the owner pretty well. She knows us. It's sort of like my Cheers, right? I walk in there and everyone knows me, even though I only go a couple times a year. And what's great about what Kathleen is doing there is that she hires people who know games, not all games, but they know enough about games. So, and each one sort of has their different area of expertise. I think that person should go, if you want to get into board games, go to your friendly local game store and just tell them that you want to try a game, and they will have a bunch of recommendations. Here's what I would say you should say to that person for a game recommendation. How many people are you going to play with? Because there are games that work better for two and games that work better for four and games that work better for more. So knowing, like, how many people are you playing with? With my older son off in college, my wife not super excited about playing board games. I'm looking, acquiring a lot of like two-player games, like literally head-to-head games. So me and my younger son can play together. Talk to them about the degree of competitiveness that you are comfortable with. Sometimes, I mean, at one end, we've got like chess, right? Very directly competitive. You are trying to eliminate the other person's king. And on the other end, we've got cooperative games where you're all working together against the game. And there's lots of variation in between. Maybe it's like, we want to each try and win, not together, but individually, but we don't want to like harm each other. Like, can you recommend games based on that? And then the last thing I would say is like, how nerdy are you about rules? Because I love reading rule books. One of my sons likes reading rule books. So it's nice to have someone who I can relate to like that, and getting really into the rules and then teaching the game. Like, that is a process I just genuinely enjoy. As frustrating as it can be, there are interesting challenges. If you have a group where, or you are not the kind of person that loves kind of digging into rules and really trying to understand them and then trying to teach them to someone, there are games that are much, much easier, have a much, let's call it, lower curve for onboarding than other games. I think coming at a friendly local game store with those three pieces of information will help someone identify a game for you that you might like. I will say, you didn't ask this, but the one game I didn't get to mention that I adore, that sort of hits every question you asked me, is a game. It's another game based on an intellectual property. It's based on the Dune series. And I think most games based on intellectual properties, known intellectual properties, are terrible. I have yet to find a really good Star Wars game, for example. I think, I don't know what it is about that franchise. It is very difficult to make an enjoyable game about it. But Dune, they did. And it's a game called Dune Imperium. There's also another flavor it called Dune Imperium Uprising. There is something about this game that is so compelling. I've played a bunch of configurations. My good friend Kenji brought his family over and we played 6-player Dune Imperium Uprising. You play 3 against 3. It works great with three as a 3-player game or as a 4-player game. Doesn't work great as a 2-player game, but and there are a lot of expansions and variations, but the game is very compelling in and of itself, but it also does a really good job of invoking and embodying the Dune universe. So I highly recommend if you are a gamer, if you're interested in games, if you like the Dune franchise, that is my kind of go-to fun game at the moment.
I think for me, I found actually success with exactly that thing of like, okay, you're a fan of Dune, for example, here are three or four different games within that universe, all have a different feel. You know, there's the classic Dune, which is more about negotiation and subterfuge. And there's this one, which is more of a deck builder and some resource management or worker placement. There's other ones that are trick-taking. It's, for me, a really great way of getting into finding your board game is thinking, is there an intellectual property that a person is already invested in? And then finding the sort of the mechanisms that they would click with.
And there is something for everyone. And one of the reviewers that I follow online, that's sort of his catchphrase. There is a game for everyone. He just reviewed a game, forgive me, but he just reviewed a game where you run a strip club. Like that, that's the whole board game. And so if there is that, there's something for everyone. One of my favorite games from Stonemaier Games is Viticulture. You run a winery, right? And I don't drink wine. I'm not interested in wine, but I love this game. I think you're right. I think if you can also start with the theme, like what themes resonate with you, because there's probably a game, and literally it could be anything. There's probably a game with that theme, and there's probably a good entry game for that theme.
Exactly. With that, Dan, where can people find you?
Well, wait, can I ask you a question first?
Of course.
You mentioned to me that you are on the verge of a very large birthday, a very monumental.
That is correct. Yes. I'm not sure when this is coming out, but it's already passed.
Okay. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
What role? Yeah, I mean, you talk to everyone about their pastimes. And as I've gotten to this age and watched my parents deal with aging, right? Watch my kids try and kind of figure out a world where the word career means something different than it did when I was starting out. What do pastimes mean to you? Based on like everything that you've talked to folks about, I feel like we're going to become less about being designers and more about these pastimes. Help me understand, like, having had these conversations, what role do pastimes play in your life?
A lot of them are about exploring different perspectives. I think board games for me play a really key role in that they allow me to enter a model of the world or a model of that I'm engaging with that I have no familiarity from my daily life. Like you said, you know, playing a game where you in 18th century France, you make dresses and costumes for people who go to Louis XV ball, one of my favorite games. It's not really my lived experience, but there is so much. I love the imagination and the immersion of putting myself into that and living there for an hour and a half.
That's awesome. And do you think the role of games is going to change in your life as you've kind of tipped over this milestone?
I don't think so. I think it's going to continue to, I'm definitely going to continue honing what I love or what I'm looking for in board games.
Become more picky in a sense.
Exactly. But it is definitely something that I see myself continue to engage with. And again, I love how you take pieces of wood or paper or cardboard or plastic, and there's a whole world that comes out of that.
This is sort of, I mean, I know we're not supposed to tie back to design, but, and I never would do this in any other circumstance other than with you, but in a sense, that is what designers do too. They take a lot of raw materials, they take a lot of rules, they take a lot of things that have no business being put together and try and figure out what can we build from this? How does this trigger the imagination? How does this kind of essentially kind of world build in our head for the problem that we're trying to solve versus, you know, trying to win a game? But I love the cognitive experience that comes from both of these activities, which starting with things that are meaningless initially, and that we kind of inject meaning and build these worlds in our mind from them. I love it.
Exactly. And I see it performing the same function that art has in creating a world out of things that are light, ink, color, paint, those kind of things. Sound.
Thank you for answering my question.
Thank you for asking a wonderful question. And with that, Dan, where can people find you?
I do most of my writing now on LinkedIn, for better or for worse. So I'm Dan Brown on LinkedIn. I also have a podcast called Unchecked, and you can find that wherever podcasts are. I wish I had kind of a board game presence, but I don't really, except every year I attend a conference. It's a small conference called the IA Conference, IAC. Next year, it'll be in April in Philadelphia. And I, for the last few years, have been hosting a board game night at IAC. When you get a lot of information architects in one space, they tend to want to play board games or do karaoke. And I run the board game. So if you want to come and talk about or play some board games in a very friendly, safe, and welcoming environment, please come to the IAC next year.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is all for this episode of Design Downtime. Thank you for joining me. And until next time, I hope you enjoy your downtime.